It's an election year, friends. Welcome to another episode of the Wednesday Conversation. I'm Bob Thune, pastor of Coram Deo Church, and I'm here alone today. Dusty White and Chris Hemmelman, my usual conversation partners, are both on vacation. On Wednesdays, we sit down to talk about how the gospel of Jesus Christ connects to the questions and issues of everyday life. And today, I want to talk about the shift in pro-life politics. So this will be a monologue today, just me offering some perspective since I don't have any conversation partners to converse with on this particular episode. But I do want to talk about some shifts we've seen in the past few months, and I guess really the past 2 years, in the strategy and tactics of pro-life politics. I think there's some interesting things for us to reflect on and some places where I might want to offer perspective to Christians wondering what should our sort of approach be to championing the cause of life as we think about our role in society. So let me begin with this simple observation. Christians are a pro-life people. That has always been the case. We are against infanticide and abortion. This goes all the way back to the Roman Empire, the earliest Christians. The Roman practice was called exposure. And what that looked like is if you gave birth to a child and you didn't want it, you just put it out on the garbage heap and let it die. And that was widely practiced in Roman society. Christians, however, started rescuing those children and raising them. And that they were so known for that throughout the Roman Empire that eventually the Roman Empire itself prohibited the practice because of the demonstrable ethical influence of Christian people. And so this is not a modern issue for us. This goes back to the dawn of the church. We have always been a people who value life and care about life. Now, for most of my lifetime, I was born in 1974. And in 1973, Roe versus Wade became the law of the land due to the Supreme Court's decision. And so for most of my lifetime, the sort of cause that animated many people in the church was the cause of pro-life advocacy. And that generally took two forms. One is just trying to care for women and children in situations of vulnerability. And the other side of that looked like advocating for the overturn of Roe versus Wade or for limits and restrictions on abortion and so forth. Obviously, a major shift came 2 years ago when the Supreme Court overturned Roe versus Wade in the Dobbs decision. We did a whole episode on that, episode 382 of this podcast back in 2022. It was called The End of Roe versus Wade, How Christians Should Respond. So since now that we're on the other side of Dobbs, what's happened in the pro-life movement is there's sort of a shift in strategy, at least on the legislative side. Obviously, Christians continue to be key advocates for pregnancy counseling and resource centers and for homes for single moms and for orphan and foster care. I mean, we continue to, Christian human beings, Christian individuals continue to lead on all of those fronts in terms of mercy and justice toward our neighbors. But when it comes to sort of the legislative and political side of the cause, things have shifted since Dobbs because now the fight tends to be state to state. And as you may have seen recently, the Republican Party changed the language of its party platform just a week or two ago and shifted sort of what the commitment to pro-life politics looks like. Shortly after that decision, R.R. Reno wrote at First Things Online this commentary. Pro-life politicians have a duty to pursue realistic objectives given political circumstances. But all of us must be witnesses to the sanctity of life. The pro-life cause has been sidelined by the Republican Party. This undermines the battle for life. Rusty Reno is a person I respect in this area. He has been a consistent voice for the pro-life cause. And he says here he believes the pro-life cause has been sidelined by the Republican Party. And he, in the next paragraph of his little essay, expresses how the language of the party has changed. Here's what he writes. The degree to which the GOP has downgraded the grave evil of abortion is striking. the final draft of the 2024 Republican Party platform champions the sanctity of marriage, although it no longer defines marriage as between one man and one woman. It repeatedly targets the radical left in higher education, but on abortion, the position is minimal. Quote, we will oppose late-term abortion. The platform allows that the states are free to pass laws protecting the unborn. These affirmations are immediately followed by pandering reassurances that the party will protect access to birth control and IVF. There is no mention of the sanctity of life. Meanwhile, some Republican candidates are attacking limits on abortion that exist in states where the pro-life position is popular. This is a confusing moment for pro-life politics. For decades, overturning Roe received most of the attention. As a result, pro-life politicians and advocates rarely had urgent debates in which prudence was weighed against principle. Now we must have such debates. Amid ominous developments, as ballot initiatives in deep red states confirm that Americans regard abortion as essential. That last paragraph is key. What he's saying is that when overturning Roe was the thing that received attention, we didn't really have to have debates about weighing prudence against principle. And he says now we actually do have to have those debates. And that's what's broadly happening in the pro-life movement or among people who care about pro-life causes. I have been paying attention a little bit to some of the people I respect in the public policy field and their response to the shifts in the Republican Party platform recently. And you generally see two kinds of responses. Some people, like Rusty Reno, say that they've sidelined the pro-life cause, or this is a major departure from the pro-life cause. Other people say, no, it's just a more pragmatic approach to that cause. It's a wider platform that sort of invites more people in because realistically we're aiming at what we can actually accomplish rather than the most ideal expression of principle. And so even in that debate, you see the debate between prudence and principle. Should the party platform reflect the principle of the sanctity of life and express all the ideals of that principle? Or should it be focused more on the prudence of what can we actually accomplish in a very divided country where, as that paragraph reminds us, many red states' ballot initiatives to restrict abortion have not been successful. It seems that even in most conservative parts of America, there's a hesitancy among the voting population to restrict abortion fully. And so what can we get done in that kind of an environment? That seems to be the debate within the pro-life movement. And as thoughtful Christians, listeners of this podcast need to weigh and think about that debate. And what does our activism and involvement require? What does it commit us to? What should our principles be as Christians? And then what is prudent for us to get behind when it comes to particular initiatives or opportunities? And I think those two questions are the things that need to be front of mind for Christians in a post-Dobbs, state-oriented world and in a nation where people are deeply divided on this issue. Let me read you some stats. A recent Gallup poll reported that 12% of Americans hold that abortion should be illegal in all circumstances, but only 35% of Americans hold that abortion should be permitted in all circumstances. The majority hold that abortion should be limited to some degree. So you have a small percentage that think it should be illegal all the time. You have a little bit larger percentage that think it should be permitted all the time. The majority of Americans land somewhere in the middle. And that's what the data shows about the populace right now. And so we have some reflection to do as Christians on what is our calling in the midst of a moment like that. I want to talk for a minute about some things happening nationally, and then I want to bring the conversation home more locally to some conversations I've been in the midst of here in the state of Nebraska. So Robert George, who is a professor at Princeton and one of the most ardent and intelligent voices for sort of a confessionally Catholic pro-life position, had this to say about President or former President Trump's perspective on abortion. He said, it's important for social conservatives to understand that Donald Trump doesn't have beliefs or convictions. He has interests. He is not pro-life, or for that matter, pro-choice, or whatever people on that side are calling themselves these days. He's pro-Trump. If embracing the pro-life position serves his interests today, he'll embrace it. If abandoning that position serves his interests tomorrow, he'll abandon it. Constancy has never been a feature of his life. Now, you may be a big Donald Trump fan, but I don't think you can disagree with what Robert George observes there. The idea that Trump doesn't have convictions, he has interests, I think is a good way of saying that. If it is in his interest to support something, he tends to get behind it. If it seems to be against his interest, you see it shift. And I think that's perhaps what's behind, as I read the news articles, what's behind the shift in the Republican Party is Trump himself exercising some influence and saying, hey, I think the platform needs to shift to be a little less convictional and a little more, let's just have a pretty stripped down vision of what it means for us to be pro-life, that gets a little less specific and a little more general, and that would gather a broader coalition behind his candidacy. So I suspect that that's some of the motivation. Now, for those of us who care about big picture national things, one of the questions that Christians have been wrestling with is, what's their responsibility for those who tend to lean Republican or who would vote Republican this election year? Do they have a responsibility to seek to change that platform over the next few years? Is it okay to embrace that platform as a less robust but still faithful vision of pro-life politics? Or should they vote, for instance, for the American Solidarity Party or do some other, take some other action, some other approach? So there's that question nationally, and I want to bracket that for a minute and talk a little bit about what's been going on locally here in our state, in the state of Nebraska, over the past few months. This election year in 2024, in the fall general election, there will be possibly three ballot measures, or there are at least petitions moving toward three different ballot initiatives in Nebraska. The first is a pro-abortion ballot initiative that would seek to enshrine the right to abortion at all times in our state. And so most Christians who are convictionally pro-life want to see that ballot initiative defeated because we do not want abortion to be entirely unrestricted and wide open in the state of Nebraska. That would be bad for human beings. It would be bad for our state. And it is not a faithful representation of God's design for life. And so Christians, knowing that that ballot initiative has been put forward by the more progressive voices in our state, have responded with two different countermeasures. So there are two different counter initiatives going forward or that have been moving forward over the past month. Now, I think the deadline for both of these was early July, and so I haven't heard yet whether they gathered the required signatures and whether they will end up on the ballot in the fall. But the two countermeasures were sort of a more incremental approach that would have enshrined in the state constitution a restriction on all abortions after 12 weeks. And that approach was based on, hey, what's a limit that a lot of people can get on board with? Sort of going back to that demographic research that shows that the majority of people are in favor of some kind of restriction on the practice of abortion. What's a limit that a lot of people can get behind? And they landed on, hey, if we restrict it after 12 weeks, that seems to be a winning strategy. So that was one ballot petition. The other initiative was a abortion abolition initiative that basically would have outlawed abortion entirely within our state. And many people saw that to be a purer pro-life ballot initiative because it was just saying, hey, we think this is morally wrong. And so we're not going to try to decide which week we should sort of restrict it at. We're just going to say it shouldn't be legal in our state. Now, as you can imagine, both of those initiatives were going forward. And so I was getting emails and phone calls during the month of June from a lot of people advancing either one or both of those ballot initiatives and saying, can we come gather signatures? Can you put the word out in your church and so forth? And so there was movement among Christians within our city and within our state to get the required number of signatures on these petitions so that these things could move forward onto the ballot. People were free to sign both. Signing one doesn't invalidate the other. And so the question was, should Christians back a more practical, prudent, incremental sort of restriction, or should Christians back a more principled, ideal sort of restriction on abortion? That local question for us in the state of Nebraska, I think, is a great summary of the broader question that we're facing in pro-life politics in America, which is, how do you weigh the difference between prudence and principle, going back to that R.R. Reno article? I am not sure of the answer to that question. I think, however, that that is correctly naming the question that many of us are wrestling with, and that really the pro-life movement hasn't had to have a very meaningful conversation about, as long as the focus was on just overturning Roe versus Wade. So we find ourselves in new territory. Now, I want to say at this point in the podcast that what I'm going to say from here forward is just my read on things. I think this is a place where there is deep freedom of conscience for Christians. So some of you listening to this podcast will favor sort of the abortion abolition approach, where we should just fight for the eradication of this from our society, and so we should have the strongest position possible against abortion and in favor of life. Others of you listening to this podcast will be more incremental and a little more pragmatic, and will say, hey, let's start with just whatever restrictions we know we can get. Let's start with a broad-based sort of approach that sort of incrementally moves the needle a little bit, and let's just start with what we know is possible. I think this is a place where Christians have, and the Bible gives us, freedom of conscience. So there is freedom for Christians to disagree here. There is freedom for Christians to embrace different approaches here. There is freedom within the Christian church and within our ethical and theological tradition for both approaches. The first thing we need to know to have intelligent conversation about this is simply that. What I have been troubled by in the conversations within our state is people making arguments that only one or the other of these approaches is the truly Christian approach. That's not only unbiblical, it's unwise. And I don't think it advances an understanding within the church of the importance of discernment and wisdom and prudence and the freedom of conscience actually given to us in Scripture. Granted that on principle we all agree, or should agree if we've read our Bibles, that life is sacred and that opposition to abortion is the faithful Christian position, the question still remains, what's the best way to advance that in a pluralistic, multicultural society where not everybody agrees with us? And again, going back to the early church, if you imagine living in the Roman Empire in the second or third century AD, and living in a world where people regularly put infants out on the trash heap and hope they die, your first approach probably isn't, let's get the Roman policy changed on this. Your first approach is, let's just show mercy toward infants in need. Let's adopt as many and care for as many as we can. And let's let our action and our compassion change the public mindset here. And so you would not tell a Christian living in the Roman Empire, you know, if you're not petitioning the Roman emperor to overturn this, you're not being a faithful Christian. Neither should you say that in our day. So I think it's important for Christians to preserve freedom of conscience here. The second thing I think we need to think about, however, is how do we build unity moving forward? Because one of the challenges in this debate is you sort of had the whole pro-life movement oriented toward one goal for about 50 years, and that was, how do we get Roe versus Wade overturned? How do we get a federal right to abortion, which does not appear in the Constitution, but which was found there by judicial decree? How would it be possible for that to get overturned? And again, that happened with the Dobbs decision, and that was a decision based on the legal question of whether that decision was properly made, and the justices decided, yeah, that's a poor legal precedent. And so it wasn't an ethical or moral decision they were making, it was a judicial one. The question was, does the Constitution enshrine a right to abortion? And the answer is no. And so this falls then back to the states, and each state is free to legislate its own personal or its own state legislation on this issue. So now that we live post Dobbs, we no longer have a unified objective as a pro-life cause. Nobody's aiming all of their darts at let's get Roe versus Wade overturned. Now in each state, the issues are different. And now in each sort of locality across the country, the question is our state sort of more red or more blue? Can we get greater restrictions passed, or should we be content with lesser restrictions? As we think about living in a multicultural, pluralistic society, how can we get as many of our neighbors buying into the need for protections for life? Is there a broad way for us to go forward here? And that's what I see sort of the Republican Party recently in their platform change even wrestling with, is a more prudent approach or a pragmatic and practical approach rather than a more principle-based one. I think, again, this is a place where Christians have freedom of conscience, but I also think it's a place where we need to be careful to not let the perfect be the enemy of the good. In our state, the simple political realities demographically are this, that while a abolition of abortion might be the ideal solution, it probably is not going to pass on the ballot this fall. If the petition gets enough signatures to land it on the ballot, it's probably not going to get voted positively by enough people to get instantiated in law. Now, there are some Christians in my circles who are sort of purists and who would say, well, that doesn't matter. We're not after what we could get done. We're after what would please the Lord. And what would please the Lord is total abolition of abortion. So let's fight for that. And the analogy that's often used here is the analogy of slavery, right? Of like, would you be content with sort of incremental freedoms for slaves if we dial the clock back a few hundred years? Or would you be rightly, as William Wilberforce and others were, fighting for the total abolition of slavery because it's morally wrong? And that argument has good moral force and it makes sense. However, we also do live in a democratic republic where change happens by the voting population. And what needs to happen is we need to win over hearts and minds and convictions. And oftentimes, though law is a part of that, if we simply legislate a change, oftentimes we're only creating further chaos down the road as the other side pushes back legislatively. And so I think there is wisdom in a more incremental approach that says, hey, what will our friends and neighbors agree to? Even my friends and neighbors who would be principally in favor of abortion probably agree that it should be restricted after a certain point. And so that might be a winning issue in our state. And if the goal is to defeat a ballot initiative that is totally committed to abortion at all times and in all ways, it seems like defeating that is more important than getting the ideal solution. So I want to appeal, I want to simply put forward for listeners that this is going to be the reality in pro-life politics for the foreseeable future. If I look at where the Republican platform has gone, if I look at sort of the conversations more broadly in the pro-life movement, this is going to be the question, weighing principle against prudence, and asking how do we go forward in the most judicious way, holding an ethical conviction about the moral evil of abortion, but also a prudential judgment on what's the best way to move forward that ethical conviction at this moment in time. Let me read a few more paragraphs from R.R. Reno, and I will post this article in the show notes in case you want to read it for yourself. Quote, as citizens and voters, we too must exercise prudence. It is counterproductive moralizing to denounce politicians who refuse to promise what cannot be done. Let me read that again. It is counterproductive moralizing to denounce politicians who refuse to promise what cannot be done. I'm going to come back and make a comment about that in a second, but let me finish out the paragraph. The case of the chemical abortifacient mifepristone is a signal example. A supermajority of Americans supports legal access to it. for pro-life advocates to denounce politicians who are otherwise supportive of the cause of life because they refuse to commit to banning mifepristone is simply unrealistic, although they can point out that its widespread use courts many medical dangers. Gay activists showed their understanding of this dynamic in 2008 when they refrained from attacking Obama. They all understood that he was on their side, and when the political reality permitted, he proved them right. The cause of life is at a turning point. Dobbs was rightly decided. Our Constitution no longer accords privileges to the culture of death. And yet, Dobbs exposed a terrible truth. The culture of death has made deep inroads into our society. The danger is twofold. Our political leaders may capitulate, deeming the battle for life not worth fighting. And we, in our rage, may fail to support those who pick their battles, fighting only where they have hope of a meaningful victory. Let us meet this challenging moment with clarity and wisdom. So you see, as Reno concludes his article, he is acknowledging that we as citizens and voters need to exercise prudence, and that we can sometimes be so idealistic that we don't embrace what is possible. I want to come back to that sentence where he says, it is counterproductive moralizing to denounce politicians who refuse to promise what cannot be done. I have said on this podcast before, I don't remember who this quote is from, but someone has wisely said that politics is the art of the possible. The point of politics is to get done what you can get done. And I think that some politicians, looking at both the local and state level data and looking at the national conversation, are concluding and have concluded that the wise strategy is to aim at what can actually be done rather than promising things that can't. So here is an example of a place where the Republican Party platform has changed. For many years, the official platform of the Republican Party called for a federal ban on all abortions. That's one of the things that was removed a few weeks ago in the new Republican platform, and that made many people very unhappy because for years, a unifying factor of sort of the conservative movement was rallying for a federal ban on abortion. However, I think part of what's happening there, the calculation that politicians are making is a federal ban on abortion is not broadly, does not have broad support right now, nor really has it ever. It was okay when everybody knew Roe versus Wade was in place because everybody knew a federal ban on abortion is impossible as long as Roe versus Wade is in place. And so the language was, again, intended to be a statement of principle. Hey, principally, we want to see our country ban all abortions. But the main practical approach was, how do we get Roe versus Wade overturned? Now that we're in a new environment, I think some pragmatic politicians are saying, hey, a federal ban on abortion is a non-starter. There's not enough energy in the nation for that right now. So let's start with what we can get done. Let's be more prudent. Let's build a platform that has sort of a more prudential approach to what we can actually accomplish. Now, every Christian on this issue has the freedom to act according to their conscience and to vote according to their conscience. I think the thing we need to be careful of is that we do not start creating and making enemies out of one another. Those who are more prudent accusing those who are standing on principle of being idealistic, and those who are standing on principle accusing those who are being more prudent of selling out. Rather, what we need to do is to say, actually, whatever you think about the new Republican Party platform, whichever of the ballot initiatives in the state of Nebraska you would have been persuaded to sign, what we need to embrace broadly is a principial opposition to abortion and a practical willingness to take whatever wins we can get that move the needle on that issue. I think that's the wise approach, the strategic approach, and the one that most applies sort of biblical wisdom to this conversation. So I hope this helps you as you think about the nature of pro-life politics at this moment in history. Again, this is a constantly changing conversation, and so we may do another podcast a year from now because things have totally changed by then. But at this moment in time, my hope is to help you think about the difference between principle and prudence, and understanding the importance of having some flexibility toward prudential approaches to this that are not perhaps ideal, but that do move the needle incrementally. So I hope this helps you understand some of the conversation you might be hearing more broadly, and I hope this helps you even recommit to the importance of the sanctity of life. Again, this is a place where Christians have always taken a stand against the popular culture, and we have always said life is valuable because every human being is made in the image of God. And so this is a place where we need to be willing to lean in and establish and stand with conviction while also adapting our policy approaches to what seems prudent and reasonable at a given time. That's all I've got for you today, so I hope that helps you think a little bit about this topic and about the conversations that will be happening all around us at the state and national level as we head toward a November election. The goal of this podcast is to equip our own church for discipleship and mission. So if you're a Christian or a church leader in some other context, hey, thanks for listening in. Our prayer is that this conversation will be helpful to you as you minister wherever God has you. We always love to hear from listeners. So if you have thoughts, questions, or future podcast topics, send an email, podcast@cdomaha.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time for another episode of the Wednesday Conversation.